Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Crime Wire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, a violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. Crime Wire is the place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in anytime during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you would like to send the Crime Wire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or you'd like to be considered for a future segment on a case for a future show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome tonight. Our special guest in our first segment is police officer turned lawyer, Gary Jenkins. Gary will discuss obtaining reports and documents from the police and other state or local government agencies. Gary was an officer with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department from 1971 through 1996. His assignments included patrol, burglary, fraud, shoplift detail, narcotics, organized crime intelligence, and homicide. After retiring from the police department, Gary attended the University of Missouri at Kansas City School of Law from 1996 to 2000 and was admitted to the Missouri Bar in 2000. He specializes in consumer fraud cases for victims. He also produced the documentary film Negroes to Hire, the story of slave life on antebellum Missouri farms. Gangland Wire is currently in production. Welcome, Gary Jenkins, to our show.
Thanks, Denny. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm Vito.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. The paperwork I have in front of me where I'm supposed to say your website is kind of blocked out here. So why don't you give us your website first of all?
It's www.lifedocumentaries.com.
Okay, very good. Welcome again to the show. Tonight's a pleasure to be an ex-cop myself and a private detective. Now, it's a pleasure to have an ex-officer on the show, especially one now that has worked hard and become a lawyer after 25 years on the job. So let me ask you a little bit. Let's go back a while. Gary, what was your – talk a little bit about your life on the streets as a cop.
I spent most of my 13 years of my career in the Organized Crime Intelligence Unit here in Kansas City, and so that was an awful lot of my experience. We had the Savella family was a Midwest mob family, is connected to Chicago, and actually took part in an investigation called the Straw Man. It was codenamed the Straw Man, and in that case, they started a bunch of wiretaps and bugs here in Kansas City based on some probable cause that actually my unit helped the local FBI with, and ended up listening in on as Tuffy DeLuna and Nick Savella were talking to Joel Gosto and Carl Thomas out in Las Vegas and discussing the skim and how they did the skim and how it went to Chicago and how they brought it back, and ended up really convicting out of Kansas City. They convicted all the heads of the mafia family here in Kansas City and Chicago, Joey Iupa, Joey Doves, and Joey the Clown Lombardo, and Ballesteri in Milwaukee and Macy Ruckman in Cleveland, and really took down, made a major dent in Midwest organized crime, and also exposed their influence over the Teamsters Union. And out of that, the I believe the Department of Justice took over the Teamsters Union, and the Mafia lost all their influence over the Central States Teamster Pension Fund. So that was the majority of my career.
Wasn't, as you were talking, it sounded very familiar. Wasn't some of that featured on a TV program? I don't know. I don't remember which one, but the what did you say, the straw man or something of that nature? Wasn't that featured on one of the
shows? The straw man was the code name of the operation. Actually, the movie Casino was based on what was going on, what they were exposing here in Kansas City. What they were listening to was, I've actually listened to a lot of those wiretaps. That's my next movie, Gangland Wire, is going to be about that investigation. And I obtained copies of all the wiretaps, the transcripts, and the actual tapes or the actual audio. And in Kansas City, they were complaining about Lefty Rosenthal left and right because he was Chicago's guy, but he was drawing too much heat. And as you notice, if you watch the movie Casino, Lefty Rosenthal is Robert De Niro's character, and he does draw a lot of heat.
And right.
Exposed him.
And coming from Chicago, you know, a lot of these guys are familiar to me. Nono DeFranzo, Iupa, you know, and they, a lot of them, are just getting reindicted now. Nono DeFranzo. Yeah,
right.
I mean, they got out. They were hanging out at a place called Giannotti's. On Cumberland Avenue, and you know, there was as a young woman myself, I was kind of impressionable with certain things, and I grew up with all those people. They didn't live very far, or my father arrested a lot of them. So, it what you're talking about is very familiar, and it's amazing how they were able to put all these together. But these people don't stay in jail very long, do they?
Well, some of them do and some of them don't. Our guys, they were old enough when they went in. They either died in jail or they were about 80 when they got out. Of course, they were almost 70 when they went in. But a lot of them, if they're younger, you know, you can do 10 years and come back out and keep on going. A normal person can't, but they can.
Interesting. Well, Gary, let's talk a little bit about your decision to go to law school. And the reason I'm saying that, you know, being an ex-cop, I know usually many fellas that retire from the police department, they may do something like I did, become a private detective.
Right.
They may go into a head of security for a major company, things of that nature. Now, to go into the law profession after, you know, after working 25 hard years, it's kind of like, well, I got to really, that's a lot of work. That's maybe even more work than being a cop, right?
I promise you, it was the easier job is being a cop than being a lawyer.
Right. Yeah,
sometimes I'd like to go back to it, but it doesn't pay as well.
You don't see many guys do that. I know ex-cops that have become lawyers, but what have happened with them is they kind of did it midstream after 10 years on the police department, 12 years, something like that, and then they do their main career as a lawyer. So I give you a lot of credit. That's excellent that you do that. Now, what do you specialize in now?
Well, it's been mainly consumer fraud. Car dealers are, you know, it's almost like shooting fish in the barrel sometimes, but it kind of keeps me still as the good guy. You can use what we call private attorney general's laws, in that the attorney general can't go after all the bad car dealers, and they can't go after all the trade schools that lie and cheat people and take their money and then fold up, and they can't go after the all the other guys that kind of do this white-collar crime. It borders on, is it a bad business deal, or was it really a fraud? And law enforcement doesn't have time to do those kinds of crimes, and the attorney general's office doesn't. So they've got laws in the state, the Missouri Merchandising Practices Act, and it allows for punitive damages, and it also allows for attorney's fees. So I have to eat what I kill, and there's not a lot of lawyers doing this. And you got to win to get paid, because my clients are always poor.
Let's get this understanding. Now, you don't work any criminal cases. You're not representing.
No, I don't.
Crime.
You know, I took.
Not representing
I had
organized
one,
crime figures. Now,
No, I had one cocaine dealer, and I don't know. He was a nice guy too, but I made him a deal, and you know, we went on, and he paid me a little money, and I went on. But I don't know. I just wasn't real comfortable doing that. I was more comfortable taking on these victims of fraud.
Well, but you did so much with the mob, you know, the mob and all those people. And how come you never wrote books about that? Or I've not seen documentaries, you know, on that as well.
Yeah, you're going to see one in the next year. I'm kind of taking a plunge. I got my feet wet with the other documentary I did, and I've actually even invested a little money in this one and got a professional film guy here in Kansas City. And we're in the middle of doing interviews now. We're going to go out to Las Vegas and do some interviews of some retired.
So you're going to interview Denny and use his books? Because he's got everybody right there with him.
I'm going to interview Denny, and he's got a good take on what happened out in Las Vegas, on the Las Vegas end of it. And then Dennis Arnoldi and Emmett Mike. Oh, gosh, I forgot his last name. I'm sorry, Emmett. But
Michael.
Emmett and a couple other guys out there that were involved, Kent Clifford that worked organized crime in Las Vegas during the 70s.
And you've got Frank Collada, and you've got
Frank's
Hill,
there.
Henry Hill, who both Denny and Vito know, right? Denny, I mean, I don't understand, Denny, how you write some of these books with these people. I don't mean it in a bad way, but you know, I can't get battered women to get help, but yet these all people have witness protection and they're living the life of luxury in Vegas, and you're doing their book stories.
Sometimes life is not fair. I've noticed that. It's not always fair.
Well, Gary, I give you a lot of credit for really doing, you know, especially after, 13 years in organized crime?
Right,
That's amazing. I mean, I did 7, 2 wearing a wire, and I just, you know, it kind of devastated me for the rest of my life. But
yeah.
I give you a lot of credit to go into such a hard profession as then becoming an attorney. So that is great. And the movie stuff now, whatever, you deserve it. In other words, bottom line is you deserve it. You put in a lot of time. You did a lot of good, great things to protect the public, and I think it's great. We wish you all the best with all those projects. Thank you.
You know, in this movie, we're going to tell this story from the agents and the police officers' side. We all get a little tired. The casino, it was all this glorifying, you know, Joe Pesci and his character, who was, you know, a stone killer. Tony Spilotro and Lefty Rosenthal was just kind of he was a slick guy, but you know, I guess I shouldn't say too much about him, but they, you know, they tend to want to make the police and law enforcement look stupid if they can, and we're going to show what really went into this.
Go ahead, Dan.
Gary, I was going to say that, first of all, I'm looking forward to your project, the documentary, and you're right, yeah, the casino and a lot of those movies are entertaining and so forth, but in many cases they're told from the mob side of things. And
right.
Like you say, a couple of times, remember in Casino, the FBI plane running out of gas and having to crash land on the golf course. So they don't always paint law enforcement necessarily in a real favorable light. But when we were talking about you coming on the show tonight, I was explaining to you that a lot of our listeners and families from the cases that we profile have problems in many cases getting records.
Right.
And let me give you a scenario, and then we'll go from there. We have a lot of the cases that are cold cases or that perhaps were originally ruled sometimes maybe prematurely as accidents or suicides when they may not have been. And the families receive a letter or information from the handling investigating agency saying this case is going to be open in the case of a homicide, for example, but it's going as an inactive. I guess you just say it's turning into a cold case.
Right.
And they will say, we will renew the investigation only upon receipt of fresh information or leads.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, the family feels, probably rightfully, that if they want this case to advance, the ball's pretty much in their court to come up with this new information or leads to get the case a second look or in some cases a first look. And when they go to the police department then and say, okay, we're going to try to do our own investigation with whatever resources we have. We'd like to take a look at what you guys have done so far, you know, and maybe we can start from there and continue. And lo and behold, they are told, well, we're sorry, since this is an open investigation, you can't have anything. You're not entitled to any reports, and you're going to have to wing it the best you can. And that seems, in a lot of cases, obviously it's frustrating to the family, because they're trying to do now, they're trying to keep the thing going, trying to get some answers.
Right.
And the agency they kind of counted on to help is telling them basically, you know, that's tough, we're not telling you anything, you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think there are many, many cases where that type of attitude is legitimate. If there's actually something going on, if there's an investigation, really an active investigation in progress,
right,
certainly you don't want to divulge anything that would screw that up. If there's something in the records that can't be redacted, where they might give somebody's name up who was an informant or something and place that person in physical danger, that certainly is understandable. But sometimes the families come away with a feeling that isn't going on, that there's nothing happening with these cases, and it's perhaps the department or the investigating agency just isn't very anxious to reveal what they did or maybe what they failed to do.
Correct.
In the way of investigation. And you can look at this from both sides now. As a former cop, you know, you can see the law enforcement side, and as an attorney who may have to get records on occasion or assist families,
right,
or victims of getting records. So what's your take on this whole issue of trying to get records from your state or local agencies?
Well, it's tough, and here's an example of in the case of homicides, and I know I even made a little run myself on old homicide cases, but to try to find pictures and things to use in my movie. And as long as it's since homicide, there's no statute of limitations on it, then they're saying that homicide files, even clear back into the 50s and 40s, they're saying homicide files are closed records and we're not going to allow anybody to get into them. And you know, it's tough. Now, you know, and I've seen as a working officer, I've seen some, all police departments, they're made up of people, and I've seen some officers who were less than competent and officers that were very competent, but sometimes, you know, police officers are, you know, they have a hierarchy and we're kind of a closed society and we don't really want anybody looking over our shoulder that's not one of us. And it's just kind of a natural restriction. And you know, that's one reason. I did a little research on this after we talked. And, you know, I think every state has some kind of a Freedom of Information Act law. And they may call it something different. In Missouri, it's called the Sunshine Law. And it will provide some guidance in going after records. And if you just talk to the, you know, if you just call down there and talk to, say, the homicide sergeant, the first thing he's going to do is say no. And you talk to the captain, and the next thing he's going to say is no. And you even go on up the rank, the chain of command, you're probably going to get nothing but no. But if you talk to the department lawyer and you look up your local sunshine law, your state sunshine law, and see if you can't fit in somewhere under that, in Missouri, it's like, for example, all incident reports and arrest reports are open records. And so you can always get the incident report of which it happened. You should always be able to get that in Missouri. And there's a penalty if they don't give it to you.
Now, and then some of the victims that we've had on other cases, they've in the documentation, that's how they've gotten it. And they have to put in there, by the way, if you do not comply, it's a $1,000 fine per the
right,
sunshine.
Right, that,
or the, but people don't know about that. And when families are grieving, they're not hearing you.
Right.
You know, and they're not listening, and they get frustrated, and they say, well, why do I have to do this? Why isn't this information more accessible for them, you know, rather than having to jump through hoops to find out what they should be able to know anyway?
Well, there's one that's a pretty good reason, and there's one that's not such a good reason, but and I kind of touched on the not-so-good reason. It's just it's a closed society. police departments are. But the other reason is, especially in homicides, people don't, you'll hold back certain things. Because anytime you work a homicide, especially if it's one that's gotten a lot of publicity, you'll always get some false confessions of some kind. Or you'll get people that come in and want to give you false leads just because they're nutcases, mainly, I think. I've interviewed them. I've had them fobbed off on me when I was a young detective. They'll fob them off onto the young detectives in the homicide unit, and you'll talk to somebody, and all of a sudden you realize this is a nutcase. But if when you get too much out there in the public, then they will, people like that will get onto those details, and then they'll want to insert themselves into this mix in some way, or you'll have a false confession. And I spent half the night. I had a kid. Informant that we even put him on a polygraph. We had a killing of about, it was a series of killings of the clerks in like Quick Trips and those kind of stores in the earlier 70s. And then he did a double killing in a Radio Shack. And I had an informant come to me that I'd known from when I was in patrol. And he told me this kid out in his neighborhood was bragging about being the one that did that Radio Shack murder. And so we even made him take a polygraph, and he passed it. I mean, this kid was out bragging that he did it, and we got him in. And we spent hours on this kid, and we spent hours on him. And he was saying he did it, but he wasn't saying he did it. And finally, an old-time detective came in, and he asked him one question. He said, tell me, he said, when you got the money, how'd you get it? How'd they give you the money? And the kid said, well, they turned around, and they hit the cash register and opened up, and they gave me the money. And the detective called me out, and he said, hey, he didn't do it. I said, how do you know? He said, because they had a cash drawer. They didn't have a cash register. Oh. And so details like that too many things get out, then you got to deal with those kind of things. And people can maybe cover their tracks or come up with other stories. So they don't want to let too many details out.
And Susan,
but yet when they don't inform the families, then they have to go to somebody like a Vito or, you know, the private investigators.
Yeah,
and Vito, what do you tell families? You know what? And you have to duplicate efforts that they should be able to get themselves.
Well, even more so than that, Susan. Going back to Denny's original question, I had worked on a murder case, big murder case, 30 years ago. It was left unsolved there after it was taken away from me and my partner. Obviously, it was given to some, let's call them unscrupulous bosses that wound up getting arrested for other things. But 25 years later, the family of the victim, now I'm a private detective, they come to me, they want me to go back and look into the case. And I said, okay, fine, let's talk to headquarters, let's talk to the lieutenant or the captain there, because I would need to get my own files, or at least my own interviews from back then, or things of that nature. I can't start from scratch. I had all my paperwork. And the family, through their attorney, went to headquarters and tried to do it. I tried to do it. And basically what we were told, and I was told, is that, Vito, it's still an ongoing investigation. And since it's an ongoing investigation, none of that can be released to you. I said, I can't even get my own information. And they said, no, because it's ongoing. So, you know, you run into that kind of a situation too, Gary.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You can always say it's ongoing. As long as the statute of limitations isn't up, you can always say it's ongoing.
That's what they do, basically. Yeah, and not only that, you know, you may have touched on a little bit before, sometimes there's that little pride issue, and you kind of say, yeah, but this is 30 years now, and the family, I remember at that time, the mother, the matriarch of the family, wanted it solved before she died. I mean, she was getting quite elderly, and she wound up dying now the last couple of years, but she, you know, the family wanted to solve it for her because they really knew who the person was, type of a thing, and all I wanted to do, just give me my original paperwork, that's all, give me my own paperwork, but, you know, what can you do when they say it's ongoing, sorry, and that's it, you know, my answer was, well, is it being worked on? No, but it's still ongoing, yes, so that ended that, you know.
Gary, first of all, let me clarify something, and I was guilty of this also until it was pointed out to me by one of our listeners. I just always lumped all these attempts to get records under Freedom of Information Act. I refer, even though you're quite right, different states have similar functions, but under different names, such as the Sunshine Law or whatever. So the Freedom of Information Act isn't necessarily the title of the records program in each state. It could be different, but the purpose of it is generally the same. And Freedom of Information Act, I guess, is actually generally is the federal act.
Correct.
To get records from federal agencies, and then your local and state would be by whatever law, whatever the official name of the law is in that state. So the first thing people should do, if I understand you, is do some research as to what the records access law is in their state.
Correct. Like I just
and read up on it and see what they're entitled to, what they're not entitled to.
But my point, Denny, is why should the families have to do that? Why can't they be given that information? I mean, their brains are mush. They're traumatized. They're looking, you know, for closure with their loved one. They're looking to find them. They're looking for whatever. Why do we make it so difficult for them to jump through hoops?
Well, I agree.
You know, it's a good question. And one option, of course, a lot of departments have a victims and prosecutors have a victims advocate that sometimes.
Oh, those are about as useless. You know, your toilet paper in your bathroom has more of a value.
Oh, really? I don't really work with them. I just know that's a new thing.
I'm just trying to say that, again, nobody owns this information. Nobody owns these cases. Nobody owns the blood. But you own the ability, in my opinion, for justice. And so to me, these families jump through hoops for this every single time, and it makes it difficult to them when they get the documents. Sometimes they're all blacked out. There's nothing there.
Yeah.
So where is the point? I mean, there has to be an easier process than what there is not now for the families.
Do you think anybody, this is to Gary or anybody who wants to comment, in some cases, and I'm not a big conspiracy guy or anything like that, but in cases of where perhaps the department isn't particularly proud of what they did or what maybe their predecessors from 25 or 30 years ago did.
It's called screwing up, Denny, yes.
Screwing up, yeah. And you know, maybe by putting up these walls, these roadblocks to making people jump through hoops, if you will, to get the information, that a lot of people will just give up. You know, they'll get turned down two or three times, and they'll say, well, you can appeal to so-and-so or this and that. And people just get exhausted. They don't have the stamina to continue to fight the battle. Can that actually, in some cases, be a strategy on the part of the department to make it so difficult that people just give up?
Oh, sure. I can see somebody doing that. I mean, I you know, if I were in that position that it was going to embarrass me or embarrass my department, why, you know, that'd be the first thing I'd use would be the, you know, the Sunshine Law and make that hoop as small as possible that they had to squeeze through in order to try to get to those records. If, you know, if I went and took a look at them, that's why you got to. Somebody said that to quote in your letter about the penalties for not giving you the records. You almost got to do it, partly in just the nature of the beast, the police departments. Where I said before, it's a really closed society. We don't really like outsiders looking at what we do.
Would the thing to do now, if a family or a person finds themselves in that situation, should they hire a lawyer or someone to represent them if they don't have the stamina or the wherewithal to continue the fight? Is that a good use of money? Or if they're going to cite the Sunshine Law and it's a homicide, like you say, those records are closed, so even an attorney probably can't do a whole lot of good for them.
Well, I would start with a letter, and if it's a small department, you about have to work through the officers through their records unit, and who will have a commander. You got to start with them. Just write a letter quoting the Sunshine Law and telling them what you want, and then they'll have to respond. They have to respond to you, and then you got something. You got at least something going there that they've acknowledged that you're trying to get these records. That's the first thing, and then. You start looking if they've a big department, they'll have a lawyer. They'll have two or three lawyers that actually are on staff that work there, And then you want to direct your correspondence to that lawyer and quote that law. An individual can do that, and I, you know, unless they just really can't get it together to do that, but I'd recommend that they just do that and themselves to get the department on record as to why they won't give you these records and see what they will give you. And
we're going to have
you
back.
Work from there. Then you may have to get a lawyer or do something something different.
We're going to have you back because we, like, are out of time.
Oh, really? Okay.
Everyone. Yeah. I mean, that half hour just flew. And maybe we could go into more, you know, actually maybe I'd like to see a show where we could present some of these cases. People can come in and ask you questions. How's that?
Okay. Sure.
All right. Gary Jenkins' website is www.lifedocumentaries.com. Thank you so much for being with us. And we'll have you back.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary.
All right.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay. Vito, thanks.
Good night.
My pleasure.
For our second segment tonight, the CrimeWire team is bringing you the case of 16-year-old Eric Cross, who was murdered in Vicksburg, Michigan on June 26, 1983. Although witnesses named Eric's killer, no arrests have been made in this nearly 28-year-old case. Eric's sister, Jackie Cross Mitchell, is here to discuss the status of the investigation and her efforts to get justice for her brother. Also joining us is reporter Rex Hall of Kalamazoo Gazette. Mr. Hall has reported extensively on Eric's murder. Jackie and Rex, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do to begin with is, Jackie, I'd like you to tell us, if you would, a little bit about your brother. Now, I believe he was 4 years older than you, so you were 12 at the time of his murder. And what you remember about Eric, what kind of a young man he was and so forth. And then I have a question for Rex.
A great brother. There was just the two of us, you know, one brother, one sister, and my parents, so he was my only brother. So we were real close growing up. You know, he taught me how to talk, you know, taught me how to do a lot of things, and we moved around a fair amount, so we were a constant in each other's lives, you know, and so we did spend a lot of time together. And we had only moved to Vicksburg, the place where he was murdered, 1 year before his murder. So, you know, even that last year, I feel like we had been getting even closer just from being in another new place, you know, and some different things that happened that year. So he was a great guy. He was very kind. You know, that's one thing my dad wrote when he wrote about Eric afterward, that he never intentionally harmed anyone. You know, and he even had second thoughts about hunting, which was one of his favorite pastimes. But he was just a real kind and friendly and fun person.
Okay, and Rex, I'm not familiar. I've never been to the Vicksburg area. I'm just wondering, what are we talking about? What type of community? Is it rural, small town, or what type of area are we talking about?
It's a small community in southwest Michigan. It's about, I would say, 20 to 25 minutes from Kalamazoo, Michigan. And in town, you have what I would call just a small town surrounded by rural areas, farm fields and places like that.
Okay, and is it a relatively low crime area?
I would say yes. I think that I would venture a guess that when this homicide happened back in 1983, it certainly was a shock for that community. I don't think that they were in any way used to any sort of crime like this at all.
Okay.
Can I ask Jackie, how was your family treated when this happened? I mean, by the town. I mean, did anybody come forth? Was it?
Well, I think that was I'm not the only one who thinks that. I've had other people tell me that they think if we had been lifelong residents of Vicksburg, that this would have been solved long ago. That one of the factors was that we just moved to the small town, and that the family who is the main suspect in the murder, you know, had lived there their whole lives. Everyone knew them. Many people.
Are they still there?
They're in this area, not in Vicksburg anymore, but they many people covered up for them, and, you know, some people reached out to my mother, and people are helping us now, but at the time, you know, too many people helped the family who did it because they were, you know, because they knew them, and they didn't know us because we were new.
Describe what happened the night before the event. The night before he died, what happened?
He told my parents he was going to his friend's house, and this friend ended up being one of the eyewitnesses to his murder and one of the people who, 3 decades later, will still not tell what he saw. So he went to this trusted friend's house, and he ended up going with the friend to this drinking party, which my parents had no idea he was going to, this party where the parents were serving alcohol. Not I shouldn't say serving alcohol to minors. They were selling alcohol to minors. So they, you know, sold. They had to pay $2 to get into this party. They went to this party at this house, and then at around 1:30, Eric started walking home and alone because his friend had already left and left him there. So he was walking home alone. Various people saw him, but he, you know, was still just by himself. And so the last time he was seen alive was about 1:30 a.m. walking toward our house. Other witnesses saw the two cars of the six persons of interest, the six suspects at the corner door, at the same time, and they even admit to being there at the time that Eric was walking by. Anyway, then he was basically missing for 4.5 hours. That part is fuzzy. You know, we don't know exactly what happened then, but we have a lot of ideas based on confessions that happened later. But anyway, they decided after they killed him to bring him back to our house at 5 a.m. to try to make it look like a hit and run. So he was definitely not in the road from 1:30 to 5 because the newspaper was delivered at 4:30 a.m. He was not there. The neighbor went out to check for his paper, and, you know, at 4, and he wasn't there. And at 5, they came, took his body out of the trunk, put it in front of our house, ran over it several times. My parents,
how do you know this? Is this account? Is this from accounts that you heard through the town?
Yeah, this is from accounts of. The part about the car going back and forth in front of our house is from my parents saw the car. The neighbor saw the car. The neighbor.
So they see the car. Stop.
Uh-huh.
They see the car. They see your brother being taken out of the car. Somebody witnesses this.
Oh no, not the part about taking him out. No.
Okay.
The part about him being in the trunk comes from one of the persons of interest and their statement to the police.
Police.
Yeah.
And is this person of interest, is he still living there?
Yes. Yeah, he lives
okay.
In Vicksburg. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The reporter, did they write about this at the time? Was it a big deal, or was it just kind of like looked at as, oh, a sneeze, that's it, no big deal, no one's ever going to catch anybody for Eric's murder?
No, I know from looking back in our archives that we did cover his death when it occurred, and I believe that we wrote a couple of stories after the fact, or after he was killed, and then followed up a year later, and those are basically the stories I found in our archives prior to Jackie and I talking back in early December.
So all those years later. Go ahead, Beto.
Jackie, at the time when this happened and for the time after that, was this possible suspect, how many times was he actually interviewed by the police? Number one, was he ever asked to take a polygraph? Do you know any of the answers to that?
Yes. Well, there's one main person of interest who confessed to another person that he did kill Eric, and he explained how he did it. That person has, as far as I know from the police, not taken a polygraph. I've never seen any record of that person taking one. He did give a very short statement in July of 1983, just in connection with all the other teenagers who gave statements that were at the party, and it was just, you know, a useless statement. He was, the detective who's working on the case now says that the police back then thought he was 16 and thought they had to get his parents' permission to interview him, and the detective now admits that that was one of the major mistakes they made back then, because he was 17 when he allegedly killed Eric, and then, you know, by the time they were, by the time he confessed to the other person and explained how he did it and that he killed Eric, he was 18. So the idea that they couldn't subtract to figure out how old the kid was makes, you know, is very suspicious to me. That sounds like just an excuse to me, but that's what they say. And then they are a wealthy family. They got the, you know, slimiest, unethical, fanciest defense attorney available in the area. And, you know, they have made him very unavailable. They did then, they put him in the mental hospital. Right after he confessed, the next day he was in the mental hospital. So that was one of their strategies. They had many different strategies to get him out of trouble, and it worked.
And it seems like now he is involved with the AA 12-step program. Is that correct?
That is correct, although he obviously has not completed the 12 steps because...
So, yeah, well, you know, obviously, he's probably listening. You know, we have a ton of guests in the chat room. We know the person that person's responsible are listening to this show. What would you like to say to them right now? Because they're there.
I would like to say to the main person of interest, you know who you are. We
give
know
me the initials.
You
know the initials? Say the initials.
Yes. B.S. It's B.S. initials.
B as in boy, they, S as in Sam? Okay.
That is correct, yes. They have caused enormous pain to our family, to my poor mother. My father has died already. And you, especially those five people who witnessed and know exactly what happened and have let us sit here in agony for 3 decades and won't tell us what happened, and you should be ashamed of yourself. And then your father, B.S., covered this up, helped you cover it up, and you won't be a man and stand up, make amends to our family. Go back and review your step 8 and what you're supposed to do in your 12-step program. Remember that there's a higher authority and that you have to answer for what you did.
Well, it seems like he's, you know, until he actually comes forward and admits to this, it seems like he has gone through his own demons now, both maybe with mental illness and obviously having trouble with alcohol to try to make things go away from his mind, but it ain't going to work. And many years have gone by. Not only that, the other people that know that he confessed to, supposedly, Jackie, the other people that know who did this, they need to come forward, because reading all the information that we have on this, there's many people out there that know. Now it's 28 years later. There's nothing to worry about. At this point, do what's right. Do what's right in life. These people have their own children, probably the same age as your brother was when he was killed. So people just need to do the right thing, and otherwise it's going to haunt you many, many years, haunt these other people.
Yeah, it has haunted them, yeah, definitely.
And Denny, in a small town, you know, because you were all over the state of New York, in a lot of those small areas like this, is there something that the family can do to get people maybe to come forward, even after all these years, even though the case is cold, to get the interest back up?
Well, certainly shows like this and getting it out in the media, you know, I don't know what Rex's plans are. Perhaps there's another story in the works or potentially in his newspaper. Those are all great things. And I think community press, for example, I can see, I'm not condoning it, but I can understand maybe when everyone was 16, 17 years old, high schoolers and so forth, there probably was a lot of peer pressure at that point, especially with most of these people probably in locals, you know, and the victim was a stranger, the new kid in town. But 28 years later, I mean, that should no longer be an issue. And like Vito just said, these people probably, they're what, mid-40s now anyway, have their own families, have their own kids, and maybe can put themselves in that position.
Area code 918, did you have a question? Hello?
Hey, Rex, can I ask you a question, Rex?
Sure, go right ahead.
How long ago did you get involved now writing about this case for the Kalamazoo Gazette?
I had been aware of the case since I started at the Gazette in 2003, just from talking to investigators with a cold case team that had recently disbanded by the time I came to Kalamazoo. That was one of the cases that was sort of on their list as a case that they, you know, wanted to solve and hoped to solve. But as far as getting involved and actually writing about Eric's case, that happened when I was able to connect with Jackie. I think it was late November or early December of last year. And it just kind of started there. And she and I spoke several times on the phone and then met at the actual scene where her brother was found. And, you know, we talked more. We shot a video of her at the scene as well as at the cemetery where her brother is buried. And I think that the story overall served the purpose or served some purpose of getting people talking again. I know that after the story ran in our newspaper and after it got posted on our website, that, you know, comments that were posted to the story after it was on our website just started flooding in. And I think that, you know, from talking to the detective who's assigned to the case now, his phone started to ring a little more, as well as the phone of the Silent Observer program here in Kalamazoo.
Yeah. Well,
Jackie, we have somebody on the phone. From Gene Cervantes wants to offer your family some help. Gene, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Gene Cervantes from Citizens Against Homicide. And if you could give me a call or send us an email, we'll be glad to talk with you and see if we can help. We can do a website entry. We could do a profile in our newsletter that gets national distribution. And I could probably do some interference for you with the lead detective or his agency.
Okay,
there are a couple other things that I might be able to do, but we could talk about that when you call, Jackie.
Okay, what's the name? Citizen what? What's the name?
Well, I'll give you my email.
Okay.
CAHTHEADVOCATE, ADVOCATE, @yahoo.com.
Okay, I got it. Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Rex Hall from the Gazette. One more thing. A lot of times people in the press don't get the respect that they're due a lot of times for different reasons. But I can tell you, and probably speaking for most of the members in the chat room tonight, kudos to you for writing about this case again. It's a 28-year-old case that you take the time and the effort to write about it, that you stir up interest, you get people talking in the area, and you just need, as an ex-cop and a private detective, I could tell you, you just need that one nugget. You've got to get that one nugget to put this case over the top. So I just want to thank you myself for putting this out there.
Yeah, it's a big deal, especially because you're in the town. You know, this is a lot. Plus, if people have information, Rex, where can they call in tips to you? Do they have a number that they can call in? I mean, is the paper able to take, if somebody says, I know something, will it be in confidence? Are they able to do that?
Well, I mean, I'm always willing to talk to whoever calls me, but I think that certainly the best route for anyone to take that has information about the case is, you know, to call the sheriff's office in Kalamazoo County directly. That number, you know, if anyone's listening and wants to write it down, it's 269-383-8723, or they can even contact the Silent Observer Program for Kalamazoo County. And they are available by phone as well as on the web. Their phone number is 269-343-2100, and their website is just KalamazooSilentObserver.com.
And
what about people? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to throw this out there. I see we have a little activity on the switchboard, and if anybody out there listening now, if you have information and you'd like to give it to Jackie directly at this time, by all means, call us, 646-478-0982, and you can speak with Jackie, and you can tell her what's on your mind, what you know or think you know. And for those people who may know something, may think they know something, but they aren't sure if it's important or not, don't sit on it. Give the Sheriff's Department a call, like Rex said. Tell them what you know or what you think you know, what you've heard, and let them make the decision how important it is. That's what they get paid to do. They're the professionals. So don't just sit on it and wonder if it's important. Have it checked out. Report it. Let a professional make the decision as to whether or not your information is important to the case. And as Vito just said, that one missing nugget might be all it takes to break this thing wide open. Don't sit on it. If you got something to say, if you think something, if you overheard something, whatever, let somebody know about it. It won't do any good staying only in your mind. You got to share it. And, again, if anybody has a comment for Jackie and would like to relay it right here on the radio show, by all means call in and we'll let you do it.
Yeah, that's what we found out with, you know, because we started the Facebook page for Eric, and some of the things, you know, so many things came in to start with. And like you said about Rex's article, that was so helpful. When Rex Hall wrote the article in the Kalamazoo Gazette in December, everything just exploded. And then some of the small things that you don't know how important they're going to be, some of those turned out to be really important to get this moving. And it is still moving. I mean, that's the thing, is the detective every week is right now interviewing new people. And I heard your segment about the police reports earlier, and so much changed when I saw the police report last month for the first time, and I saw that the three persons of interest who took lie detectors failed them all. Those are the people who are eyewitnesses. You know, we know they were there. We know they saw what happened. And the only person that I've seen the lie detector test that passed was the one who heard BS say, "I tied a rope around Eric's chest. I tied it to the bumper of my car, and I dragged him around the block. I killed Eric Cross."
Hey, Jack, we're going to take a call from Andrea, who's on the line. Go ahead, Andrea.
Okay. Hi, Jackie and everyone there. One of the things that I find very frustrating for us as family is the fact that we have had people multiple times confess to this murder, both the main one, BS, and another one who's come forward recently, and yet I'm told by the police officer or the detective that much of the confessions, many of the confessions we're getting, because the persons of interest are drinking at the time or maybe on drugs at the time, that what they say is not a viable confession. And we just kind of wonder how many people do we have to have confess before something is done?
Right, that's what I said. Does he have to take out a billboard? Does he have to take out a full-page ad in the Gazette? Because that's not the only confession. He has told multiple people that he killed Eric. And, you know, how many people does he have to tell before they start taking it seriously or just go out and arrest him? Yeah, that's a good question.
Do you think, Jackie, this BS ending up, you say, in a mental hospital, do you think there was actually a legit mental issue, or was it a smokescreen to keep him out of the clutches of the police and out of being interviewed at the time, or make anything he said questionable because of his mental alleged mental problems? Do you think it was legitimate, or do you think it was an act?
The police think it was an act. They've repeatedly said to me, well, because he went around town saying he was Jesus Christ, walked into different churches saying he was Jesus Christ, that he took out Eric because he was Jesus Christ and it was Eric's time. But none of that happened until after he killed Eric. So that's the police. This is something they've said to me many times. He was never Jesus Christ until after he killed Eric. You know, so at the time, he was perfectly sane. Yeah, we think it's a smokescreen. We have one of my, the process server who went to serve him when he was in the mental hospital gave a long statement about how he was the most sane patient in the whole hospital, totally coherent, knew exactly why the process server was there, you know, knew I was completely alert and, you know, was just hanging out there in the mental hospital with all the crazy people. So, yeah, I think it's an act.
Thanks for the call, Miss.
You're welcome.
Yes, thank you. And you know, we're not taking, we are loaded on the board so much, I'm not going to do this because we don't have that much time left. But are there some other things that you've been doing as far as in town?
We got to do a repeat
Pardon me?
Show on this.
We're going to have to do a repeat show.
Can I ask you a question, Susan?
Yeah.
Our live stream will get cut off in about 5 minutes. Can we not stay on and answer the calls on the switchboard? Just
I don't want to. You know what? Let's not. Only because I have to go screen them all, and I don't know that anything that anybody's going to say is going to be. You know, this is the problem too. In cases like this, it's not that we're trying to control any information. We have to be careful of what comes out. So
yeah.
That would mean for me to go to every person other than the – I think that we just repeat the show. I think that after this show, you know, because of the chat, people in the listening area here in the chat and that are listening that aren't in the chat, all over it, and especially in this town – I think that we do a show where we take questions next time, and we do it that way because, again, we have to be careful. Maybe it's somebody that's going to say the wrong thing or say something that they shouldn't say, which happens a lot, and then it's recorded forever, and then a defense attorney gets a hold of it, we're done for. So, and the only person that loses would be Eric, so I don't want to do that.
Okay, but are you, Jackie and Rex, or would you both be consider the possibility of doing another show on this?
Sure,
yes, I could do it again.
Because the board is jammed, beyond jammed. I mean, it's there's probably 20 people waiting in the queue to ask a question. But again, I think that if we do that in such a way where we take calls for a show, then we're pre-prepared. And this was about also tonight about getting the information out there. Again, knowing that the person responsible, persons, is listening right now, and that this is going to get a lot of heat because, Vito, what happens when these cases don't get heat and they just sit dormant? People don't think that they're going to get caught, do they?
That's right. That's right. Now it's been featured in the paper again now by Rex Hall. We're profiling it. Our biggest show ever. We always have a good listener base, but tonight this like is off the charts tonight because so many people want to call in either with information or to make comments about the case. So we need to do a follow-up show as soon as we can, keep the flow going, because a lot of the cases we get are extremely hard to solve, okay? This one is not, okay? This one should be a fairly easy case with a couple of things falling in place to solve, and the family needs to put this to rest.
And then we can also put them on some other shows as well.
Right, definitely, yeah, yep.
Rex, as a journalist, a reporter, what's your understanding or impression of the status of the investigation now, the police investigation? Do you have a sense they're really close to anything, or what's your feel?
I don't have a sense of how close they are, but I do certainly get a sense from the detective that that things are moving. And what exactly that means, I don't know, but... I think that he is certainly doing interviews, and the investigation is pretty active right now. And I think, from that standpoint, it's a good thing, because as long as it's active and as long as he's getting information flowing in, you know, there's always the chance that he's going to get that one person that's finally going to give him, you know, that piece of information that they believe they need to take this to the prosecutor.
And I think that what we need to do in between the time that we have, because we're going to have to say goodbye right now, but in between the time we do the next now and the next show that we start putting together evidence and do some things, we may even come to Kalamazoo, Michigan, and you won't see us. Thank you to the Crime Wire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, February 22nd, 2011. Mark your calendars for February 27th for a very special Crime Wire show. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes, interrupt, and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us tonight on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com, or to hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play.
Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard. When there is nowhere else to turn, please visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, and Susan Murphy Milano. And thank you very much to our guests, and have a very pleasant night.
Bye-bye.
Thank
bye-bye.
You so much
bye-bye.
For having us on.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You're welcome. Good night.
Bye-bye.